Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Michael Waters. Michael Waters teaches at Monmouth University and in the Drew University MFA program in poetry and poetry in translation. His 8 books of poems include Darling Vulgarity, finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Parthenope, New and Selected Poems, finalist for the Patterson Poetry Prize, Green Ash, Red Maple, Black Gum, all published by BOA. Also, Bountiful, The Burden Lifters, and Anniversary of the Air, published by Carnegie Mellon Press. His new book, entitled Gospel Night, just came out in 2011 and was also published by BOA. And I'm really happy to welcome Michael Waters. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Jan.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. So you're going to read from a selected poems, is that correct?
This is a selected poems that was published in England last year.
Oh, great. Congratulations
on it. Thank you. This first poem is about the night I was conceived. It's titled Reading Dickens. Not long after the war, my father bought, by mail, the complete set of the works of Charles Dickens, each book bound in black and red imitation leather, the titles embossed in gold. The set filled a small bookcase near an overstuffed chair where my father spent languid evenings in lamplight, feet propped on the hassock, while David Copperfield and honest Nicholas Nickleby fought their unsure way through a wicked world. He might have imagined me, his only son, not yet born, on his lap, learning to read. Each time he finished a book, he slipped a dollar between the gilt-edged pages. Some nights, the money low, he and my mother bounced before the bookcase, shaking each volume, the few bills falling, enough for dinner or the double feature. Decades later, reading Dickens, I imagine those early years, their slow stroll home, her arm circling his waist, the whistling papery leaves, the bath she drew before bed while he waited downstairs, reading Dickens, happy not to be living some great adventure, happy to close the book before my mother slept, saving the ending for tomorrow. This is a poem about that Brooklyn boyhood and about becoming a writer. It's called Horse. The first horse I ever saw was hauling a wagon stacked with furniture past storefronts along Knickerbocker Avenue. He was taller than a car, blue-black with flies, and bits of green ribbon tied to his mane bounced near his caked and rheumy eyes. I had seen horses in books before, but this horse shimmered in the Brooklyn noon. I could hear his hooves strike the tar, the colossal nostrils snort back the heat, and breathe his inexorable dung-tinged fume. Under the enormous belly, his swung like the policeman's nightstick, a dowsing rod longer than my arm. Even the Catholic girls could see it, hung there like a rubber spigot. When he let loose, the steaming street flowed with frothy, a spattering urine. And when he stopped to let the junk man toss a table top onto the wagon bed, I worked behind his triangular head to touch his foreleg above the knee, the muscle jerking the mat of hair. Horse, I remember thinking. 4 years old and standing there, struck momentarily dumb, while the power gathered in his thigh surged like language into my thumb. This poem is called Scotch and Sun. Home from night shift, my father was too wired from fighting warehouse fires to sleep, so he'd sip several Dewars, then rouse me for a morning at the beach. There, the combination of scotch and sun would knock him out for a couple hours while I invented tasks near the breakage, skimming clamshells, counting one-legged gulls, till he woke to hoist me onto his shoulders and march into the sea deeper with each step. He'd look down to find a boy propped there, his blazing, acceptable burden, his crown, almost an abstraction shimmering from his skull, some image of himself he once believed he'd been, then arch his neck to shut away the glare. That noon, I leaned too far back, back until my head dipped into the combers, then below. I struggled, thrashing my legs, but my father clasped them tighter, closer to his chest, oblivious, and went on breasting the rollers, teasing the undertow. Those broad shoulders eclipsed the sun. Then hands grasped my hair. I was choking, while my startled father stammered excuses to the impromptu chorus of gawking bathers. He was more surprised than I, more scared. He shook when he told my furious mother. "I simply had no idea," he said. "Jesus, that boy almost drowned, though I held him in my arms."
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Michael Waters. He's reading from his selected poems. Michael, I wanted to ask you about, well, first of all, you're such a strong reader, and it's easy to get lost in the sound of your poems as a listener in a great way. And so I had to really concentrate when you were reading because I didn't really want to think about anything. I just wanted to listen. So, I mean, that's such a great thing.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I think not many writers have that fullness of sound and fullness of content moving together. And I think you really have it. Can you talk about that interaction in your work?
Oh, thanks so much. A poet whose work I admire very much, the late John Logan, had said that a poem is not a poem unless it has a gorgeous musical surface. And I think that in these days of free verse, if we want our poems to be memorable, they're going to be memorable in part because of their musical phrasings. A poem is always a poem because of how it's told, not simply because of what it says. And it seems to me that those two things have to conflate in such a way that one is inextricable, really, from the other.
Mm-hmm. And so those musical phrasings, do they come to you often at the beginning of the poem, or they come in revision primarily?
They come in revision, but I don't wind up writing full drafts and then revising again and then writing another full draft and revising. For me, the revision process takes place during the writing of the poem, and I've always only worked on one poem at a time until I find myself sort of exhausting what I think of as exhausting its possibilities.
Really?
Well, I'm always envious of those poets who tell me, oh, I'm working on five or seven things at a time. I wish that I could do that, but I've never been able to.
Well, I think it would be great to work on one at a time, but I can't finish. I can't finish the one, so that's why I go to the next one. But interesting. Well, aren't you afraid that you're going to lose something? I mean, I would be afraid that if I was revising in the moment or revising on that same poem, that I would need something that I don't have yet, whether it's some knowledge from my life or from life that hasn't arrived yet that needs to go into that poem. What if it's not time for that poem? You know what I mean?
Well, I lose things all the time. I mean, it's that happens, and poems are abandoned or thrown away or just, you know, put aside for, you know, a number of years and work their way sometimes differently into other poems. But what I do is I like to write by ear, and what I mean by that, I guess, is that I let the sounds of words suggest other words with similar sounds as I work my way through the poem or down the page. And it becomes a way of, for me it's very liberating, but it becomes another way of thinking. It becomes a thought process, really. And the thought process extends itself, it seems, musical phrase by musical phrase or cadence by cadence.
And sometimes that sound connection leads you to different content.
Yeah, very much so, I think. And it's also a way for me, what's most important in poetry, I don't write prose. And for me, what's most important is that integrity of the line of poetry. And so I think of poems as being constructed by lines as opposed to, say, prose, which is constructed by sentences. And what interests me most is the construction of the line and how that functions within the poem.
Sure. Okay, could you read some more?
Sure. Here's a poem from the new book, Gospel Night. This poem is set in Tamarindo in Costa Rica. It's on the Pacific coast, and it's just below the Nicaraguan border. And it's named after the river there, Rio Sevegre. Where the Pacific sees the river, tugged limbs, then torso toward murkier waters. I turned back, struggled briefly, tore a path through the thousand frayed sienna ribbons. I fought toward scabbed boys jabbering Spanish, waving skinny arms like burnt tinder sticks. I'd wanted to cross to the cloistered beach where turtles oared ashore to bury eggs. That night I learned what the voices counseled, where salt and fresh waters tumble and stir, shark and crocodile sunder together. I was lucky to leave that turbid bath. Now I awaken when church bells worry to recall my shade taken by current, riven on the water's skin, wrenched apart black rag by black rag, as the soul is torn, the heart bitten, as I stumble away, too dumb to know which creatures seethe below and how whitely the body must beckon. Here's another poem from Gospel Night. The poem is titled Beloved. It takes place in Romania in 1989, which was the year of the revolution there. It's dedicated to my wife, Mihaela, who grew up in communist Romania and was 17 when the revolution took place. But the title also refers to a contemporary novel, with which most of you are probably familiar. She would go to the library there, and the library had no heat, and it also had no light because the bulbs had burnt out. The poem mentions this. So she would have to bring her own light bulb to the library in order to read. And I think you'd have to be someone who wants very much to read, someone who must love literature very much in order to go through something like this, in order to read these books. Beloved. She cradles the rag-swathed 40-watt bulb like a hand-painted egg in woolen gloves with holes scissored at forefinger and thumb for turning pages in the icy nook. The library looms beyond gritty drifts, past blood-soaked slats and the empty, grease-glossed hooks beckoning from butcher shop windows. Last week, she began reading Ethan Frome, a donated copy, some Fulbright profs, and felt that New England a snowscape her own, but the volumes vanished between visits. She hopes Ethan chose love over duty. Still, she can't bring herself to steal a book. Ceaușescu won't be shot until Christmas. She scours shelves for American novels. Overhead bulbs fizzled out years ago, then finds the harrowing tale of a slave that makes her bulb seem to surge with power hour after hour in the cold cubicle. A decade later, she'll meet the author. 16 now, she can't anticipate much except to be loved as she loves these books. Here's an earlier poem that's set in Thailand, on the island of Koh Samui. It's titled Miles Weeping. To hear Miles weep for the first time, the notes bent back into his spent frame to keep them from soaring away, I had to click the phonograph off and hug myself to stop the shaking. I'd recognize the human cry beyond any longing given a name. If ever he let go that grief, he might not touch his horn again. That cry rose in another country, full-throated in awkward English. I still have the envelope, unstamped, addressed to Mother Father, its oily scrap of paper torn from a primer, the characters like the inky root hairs scrawling the washed-out soil. Leck, every boy's nickname, wrote he was, quote, to be up against, meaning, I guess, that his future was end-stopped, one unbroken line of tabletops waiting to be wiped. He'd walked miles along the coast to find us combing the beach, then stood, a little Buddhist, with bowed head, while we read his letter, composed with the help of the schoolmaster. How could we deny the yearning ambition to abandon the impossible land of his fathers to begin again? We could only refuse in a silent way. When someone asked Miles Davis why he wouldn't play ballads anymore, he replied, "Because I love them too much." All that we never say to each other, the intimacies we can't complete, those ineluctable fragments to be up against.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Michael Waters, reading from his selected poems. And I really like, Michael, how you connect reading or books with inside your poems, with what's being written. And often when writers do that, it turns out badly in my experience. It feels forced or, you know, or like someone's showing off in some way, oh, I've read this and this, but it's never that way in your work. And it seems so organic and full of passion. Obviously, you love books and reading, but can you talk about that choice to include that in your work? You know, talk about reading, talking about books, talking about, I think it was in your first poem, the conception poem, Dickens, reading Dickens. Can you talk about including that rather than not? Do you know what I mean?
Sure. No, I mean, I've led a life among books. It was very important for me early on to walk to the library and to come home with an armful of books. That was very exciting then. There's a poem by Adam Zagajewski where he says something like, and I'm probably misquoting slightly, but he says, poems from poems, songs from songs, paintings from paintings, all of this friendly impregnation. And that's how I think of it. I mean, I love that idea of a friendly impregnation where I'm just constantly, I mean, this is the life of any writer is not only the daily life of, you know, picking up clothes from the dry cleaners and shopping at Food Right and, you know, dealing with folks, but it also has to do with the life of the mind. And that's the life that comes through reading so many books and pulling in not only what's good and admirable and what teaches us, but also those books that we don't like, those poems that we don't like, and trying to articulate why, I mean, articulate at least in our own minds, why we don't like that, why we want to write like someone but not like someone else. And so all of these voices, it seems to me, are constantly going through my head. I can't bear it when a student says to me, oh, I don't want to read anything because I'm afraid of being influenced. And I think, you know, no, you want to read everything, and your voice will emerge from all of those other voices that are there.
That's right. That's right. And I feel like on a lot of levels, there's a sense of relationship in your work between people, between countries, you know, between books and the poem being written. A sense, you have some war poems in Gospel Night that talk about a sense of complicity. And I think that sense of complicity is moving around in your work, whether it's a positive complicity or not, all the time. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I do agree with that. And sometimes that complicity is helpless on our part. You know, sometimes we want that, I think. And I like this idea of having conversations always with other writers, even conversations with people that we're unable to talk to, people like, you know, politicians or the new pope, let's say. You know, so I wind up having to say what I would like to say to these folks, you know, somehow in my poems, I think, sometimes consciously, oftentimes otherwise.
Okay. Could you read some more then?
Well, here's a poem that maybe you were referring to. This is a poem that's based on a painting that I saw by Caravaggio. It's in St. John's Co-Cathedral on the island of Malta. It's titled The Beheading of St. John, and it was painted in 1608. But I was thinking about the war that's going on. If it's not going on at the moment in Iraq, it's going on in Afghanistan. There's always a war, it seems, going on somewhere. And sometimes I feel, as other poets have felt before me, that even though I'm not physically involved in that war, that I'm still a casualty of that war, that Americans are certainly casualties of this war in terms of our psychological and emotional makeup here. So this poem is called Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio. The Baptist beheaded Arab fashion, throat slit with the long sword, then the gristly tendons of the neck severed with the knife, still sheathed behind this executioner's back. The beheading's not quite over yet, like the tape loop broadcast on CNN. Al-Qaeda zealots crisscrossed with bullets, posing with the blindfolded journalist before the anonymous assassin steps forward to undertake his righteous labor. On websites, the tape winds forward to the crass, theatrical brandishing of the skull, another obscene gesture in a war targeted towards spectacle. Two prisoners gape from their somber cell. The girl servant grips the copper platter upon which the head will be presented to Salome. Blood puddles the stone floor, where, a swirl, it twists into the artist's only surviving signature, Michael, to confess his helpless complicity.
Yeah, that is one of the poems I was thinking about. And I mean, I really like the unpredictable movements in your poems and what details show up in poems together that sort of collide and create this passion and this power. I know that you've taught all over the world, and you have some poems from many different places. Do you think that that's really deepened your poetry, that kind of living other places, or do you think you would have written those poems anyway, or poems similar to those?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that living abroad has given me a different perspective on America, and poems that I've written that are set in America are usually written abroad, and then the poems that are written about my being abroad seem to be written when I'm back home in the comforts here of our own country. And I don't think I need to travel to write poems, but at the same time, this notion of traveling for me means not moving about. What I generally do is go to a place and settle in as best I can. So I try not to be the tourist then, and I try to set myself up where I can be in a place where I have nothing else to do really but write, and I don't have the usual distractions that we have here at home of the telephone, of the computer, of the refrigerator, of friends even. So.
Okay. Could you read more then?
Sure. Here's another poem that touches on politics. And this is a poem that sort of conflates the form of the sonnet with the form of the Persian form of the what we're pronouncing these days, Ghazal, then Ghazal. And it's titled Dead Iraqis. On our balcony, two Iraqis are eating a dead Iraqi that has ruffled in rain for 3 days. One more dead Iraqi beginning slow dissolution until only feathers remain. Some plague has infected the city. Dead Iraqis litter rooftops, and sick Iraqis like ripped petticoats remain underfoot, dazed, or remain on roadways till crushed by trucks. Those dead Iraqis are eaten in ragged cotillions. Soon more dead Iraqis befoul schoolyards and parks. Children kick dead Iraqis like soccer balls, explosive bursts of feathers, dead Iraqis a pinwheeling in air where almost no live Iraqis remain. For the first few days, it didn't register. Dead Iraqis high and low. Everywhere you looked, dead Iraqis. Then, like a poem startling in its clarity, oh, the Iraqis, dead. Here's an earlier poem. I believe in poems of deep feeling, the poems that Wordsworth called for. This is a poem titled Green Ash, Red Maple, Black Gum. How often the names of trees consoled me, how I would repeat to myself, green ash, while the marriage smoldered in the not talking, red maple, when the less than tenderness flashed, then black gum, as I lay next to you in the not sleeping, in the not lovemaking. Those days I tramped the morass of the preserve, ancient ash smudging shadows on stagnant pools, the few wintry souls skulking abandoned wharves. In my notebook, I copied plaques screwed to bark, sketching the trunk's scission, a minor Audubon bearing loneliness like a rucksack. And did the trees assume a deeper silence? Did their gravity and burl and centuries-old patience dignify this country, our sorrow? So as I lay there, the roof bursting with invisible branches, the darkness doubling in their shade, the accusations turning truths in the not loving, green ash, red maple, black gum, I prayed, in the never been faithful, in the don't touch me, in the can't bear it any longer. Black gum, black gum, black gum. This poem is titled Parthenope, and it takes place on the island of the Greek island of Ios. Once we beheld the brilliance of our estate reflected in the haloed serenity of the girl who prepared the basketful of cucumbers for salad, slicing each nub into watery wheels, columns of coins in the egg-white bowl. Then she'd lift each miniature transparency as she'd seen the priest flourish the host, thumb the serrated blade to nick the green, then twist her wrist to peel back the dust-plumed skin, the rubbery shavings heaping a wild garden, unspoiled Eden on the wooden counter. Again and again she consecrated each wafer. We basked in her patience, that rapt transportation, her bell-shaped narrowing eyelids as she spun one papery sun, then the next, her perfect happiness, smoke from the blackened grillwork wreathing her hair, the fat of the slaughtered lamb hissing in the fire. Her name, we'd asked our waiter, was Parthenope, Little Virgin. We were still a couple then, our summer's lazy task to gather anecdotes toward one future, each shared and touching particular to be recited over baked brie and chilled Chardonnay in the grasp of some furious, if distant, winter. Parthenope, one of us might say, chiming a glass, but the common measure of love is loss. The cucumbers glistened in oil and time.
The poetry of Michael Waters. Thank you so much. It was great.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.